You're listening to The Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, the editor-at-large at The Diplomat. Unlike normal, I'm not joined today by my normal co-host, Katie, but I'm absolutely delighted to have joining me today a guest that is new to the Asia geopolitics podcast. Joining me from Singapore is Dr. Paco Milhiet. Paco, thank you so much for taking the time this morning to join me. How are you doing today?
I'm very fine. Thank you very much for hosting me. I'm a regular listener of the podcast, so it's a pleasure and an honor to participate this morning in Singapore and this evening in Washington.
Absolutely. No, and I think having you on the show, so for listeners who don't know, Paco works quite a bit on France's role in the Indo-Pacific. He's spent quite a bit of time looking at the implication of the broader Indo-Pacific region, and particularly the Oceania and Polynesia regions for France's broader foreign policy and geostrategic outlook to the region. So we're going to turn our attention to something that we have discussed on this podcast in the past, but we haven't talked about in a while. So, Paco, maybe to open up, you can maybe help orient our listeners a little bit with the reasons that France has interests in the Indo-Pacific region in general. Because, of course, for many of our listeners, I think when they think of France, they will, of course, imagine the hexagon, the country in Western Europe. But what is France's fundamental interest in the Indo-Pacific? And perhaps you can tell us a little bit about the historical origins of that interest.
Sure. So since May 2018, the current French president, Emmanuel Macron, has formalized a strategy of the French Indo-Pacific to legitimize and enhance the French assets in the region, military, economy, diplomacy, political, with two inaugural speech. One was in Australia, Sydney, a few days later in Nouméa. So that was in May 2018. So the Indo-Pacific concept had been adopted previously by other states, right? You know this, Australia, India, the US. So it's not an invention or a specificity of the French diplomacy. However, it made sense for the French diplomacy to adopt such a concept for at least two reasons. I see mainly two big reasons. First, that could apply also to any Western European power, would be basically asserting as a middle power global ambition that requires active engagement in the Indo-Pacific. The Indo-Pacific region holds a significant strategic importance for EU, the European Union, but also European states as a global economic power. Approximately 80% of the EU external trade depends on maritime routes. 37% of the imports come from the Indo-Pacific. So yeah, those figures underscore the region's vital role of the Indo-Pacific in the EU trade architecture. And so, The region basically serves as key framework for demonstrating international commitment to a stable multi-power order grounded on the rule of law, freedom of navigation, inclusive multilateral system, especially nowadays in an international context marked by growing uncertainty and the rise of unilateralism. So yeah, France seeks to position itself as a kind of spokesperson for the European Union in the region. But yeah, that's the first component of the French Indo-Pacific strategy, would be like a European one.
Yeah.
The second component, which is more specific to France, is obviously the exercise of sovereignty in the region, France as a resident power. And it's exactly what underpins France's specificity and credibility in the region with the French Indo-Pacific Oversea Collectivities, which in my diplomat articles I call the FIPOX, which is kind of a weird acronym, but let's call them like this. So you have seven of them, three in the Indian Ocean, La Réunion, the island of La Réunion, Mayotte, and what we call in French the TAF, which are the Southern and Antarctic lands in English. Mm-hmm. So that's in the Western Indian Ocean, and in the Pacific, New Caledonia, Wallis and Futuna, French Polynesia, and last and probably least, Clipperton Island off the coast of Mexico.
Right. I think that's a really helpful overview of both the geography and the strategic outlook. Of course, it's worth emphasizing that France has the largest exclusive economic zone in this part of the world as well, right?
Sure. So that's what really notable about those French overseas collectivities. It's only 1.6 million people, but it's 90 more than 90% of the French EEZ, which is the second worldwide after the US. So yeah, that represents a key interest and a major geopolitical asset. So it's also permanent military deployment in the region. We have 8,000 permanent military deploy permanent military staff deployed permanently in the regions. So yeah, it is quite a big component of the French Indo-Pacific strategy.
Absolutely. So zooming out a little bit, thank you for that terrific overview of the French approach fundamentally to this region and its the geographic layout of French interests. I wanted to ask you a little bit about, of course, the core story of essentially what we talk about repeatedly on this podcast, which is the rising tension between in the region between a rising China, more assertive regarding its territorial and broader interests in of course the first island chain, but even deeper into the broader Pacific, and the role that the United States has traditionally played in this Indo-Pacific region. The U.S. being the status quo superpower with treaty allies and partners in the region, of course, having gone through a bit of a transition, as Katie and I have talked about on recent episodes, and this rising China. So, viewed from Paris, of course, France being an ally of the United States, there's an obvious affinity there between how the U.S. is supporting a status quo regional architecture in the region. But say a little bit about how the view from Paris looks when you're thinking about the Indo-Pacific and these overseas territories. How does the U.S.-China competition look from the vantage point of a French observer interested in the Pacific region?
Sure. So that's an interesting point because many commentators have speculated that the Indo-Pacific framework was basically a way to contain China. For France was really different from the beginning. So we have this saying that the US, of course, is a key partner, is a major partner, specifically in the Pacific. Every French military deployment in the regions depends heavily on the US infrastructure. But what we say is that we're allied but not aligned. So that's basically our stance towards the US and towards China is that we have a responsible dialogue with China. So yeah, we kind of want to promote this balanced approach. From the beginning, the Indo-French Indo-Pacific strategy emphasized on the concept of inclusivity, basically meaning this is not a strategy directed against China. We want to be some kind of middle power. Emmanuel Macron, which is now which, who is now in Vietnam and Indonesia, like today, emphasize on a third way strategy, a balanced position. So that would be the core component of the French Indo-Pacific strategy. We want to be a middle power, a balanced power, not leaning towards China or the US. That being said, the French diplomat have also emphasized that balancing does not mean equilibrium, which means that we'll always be more closer to the US than China, but still we want to maintain good relation with both.
Right. So, on that note, I did want to ask you a little bit about the impression in Paris, or your personal view, frankly. You don't have to speak for all of France here on this podcast, but I kind of want your personal view as an analyst. Obviously, the last few months, as we've been discussing on this podcast, have been a bit of a wake-up call about the shifting U.S. approach to the Indo-Pacific. Of course, lots to say there on shifting approach to trade policy, to alliances in the region. How is the Trump phenomenon being viewed from the vantage point of a French observer thinking about the Pacific region? Is there any specific reason to be concerned? There is, of course, the view here in Washington that this administration is rather inclined to subsume what is a complex geopolitical region into essentially a broader framework of competition with China. But how have the recent developments in Washington been viewed from your vantage point when it comes to this particular region?
Yeah, so it's a funny story because when the Trump administration initially announced on the Liberation Day its tariff policy, some French overseas collectivities were more targeted than the European Union. So people thought like, wow, is Donald Trump officially contesting the French sovereignty in overseas territories? So
Interesting.
those measures were quickly reversed. So it's probably more a sign of ignorance
Than
of the
malice.
French of the French specificities from the Trump administration. But globally, I think for now, the Franco-US relation in Trump 2.0 is more about the transatlantic relation. We haven't heard much about
Right.
the French Pacific or Indian Ocean collectivity territories. So let's see. We're never sure about the what this administration could say in the following weeks. Some commentators in France have speculated on whether or not Donald Trump could have like expansionist some kind of ambition towards those territories. Like he said, Canada could be a 51st state, so why not French Polynesia or New Caledonia? But that's obviously more of a joke. So right now we have very few elements to say how the Trump administration would like conduct its policy towards the French overseas collectivities. But what needs to be noted is that France and America are really key partners in the Indo-Pacific and specifically in the South Pacific. So I'm not sure whether the Trump administration would be very aggressive towards France in the region. And also, furthermore, if France sovereignty would be undermined in those territories, obviously, people would probably see this as a good step for Chinese ambition in the region. So, yeah, I think I'm not sure we'll hear a lot of Trump on those issues.
Okay, so changing gears a little bit, Paco, I wanted to ask you, given your particular expertise, to maybe help our listeners understand a little bit, the last year's events, essentially in New Caledonia. This is something that essentially broke out a year ago, but listeners that may not be aware, the French Overseas Territory of New Caledonia experienced protests and rioting beginning in May 2024. And you know, I'm not an expert on this at all, but I did want to kind of ask you a little bit to reflect on the causes of this. My understanding is that there was a constitutional modification effort in France that largely led to this, resulting in a sudden eruption of violence that led to a declaration of a state of emergency. So this seems rather interesting. There is a geopolitical angle to this as well, potentially. What is your assessment of this? What caused this? Walk our listeners a little bit through the context of what happened in 2024 in New Caledonia and what the state of the territory is today with regard to the crisis that broke out last year.
Sure. So it's a very long story and a highly sensible subject nowadays. So I'll try to give a very synthetic and neutral overview of the problem. But so basically, New Caledonia, first of all, is an island located in the Southwest Pacific in the Melanesian area. Was populated 3,000 years ago by Austronesians, what we call today the Kanak, and discovered in the 18th century by Europeans, notably James Cook, but fall under French administration in 1853. So first, the French used it as a penitentiary settlement, a bit like the British in Australia. And like very quickly, the Kanak people, so the original people from New Caledonia, became a minority because of successive immigration waves from Europe and from Asia. combined with the devastating effects of modernization, disease, violence. So the Kanak people have been highly discriminated by French colonial power, with discrimination and land dispossession under colonial rule. But they began to acquire civil rights after the Second World War, so in the 20th century. The broader decolonization movement led to independence aspiration, let's say. In the 80s, there was a quasi-civil war. We call them les événements in French, but it was a quasi-civil war. And it peaked in 1988 when 26 police French officers were being held hostage, that eventually led to military intervention. So in the afterword of this tragic event, political negotiation led to the signing of several agreements, notably the Nouméa Accord, which is important, in 1988, that provided for gradual transfer of competencies to local authorities, the creation of restricted electoral role for local election, and that's a key point for today's problems, and organization of self-referendum. So between 2018 and 2021, so that was very recent, three independence referendum were organized in New Caledonia. The three results rejected independence. A majority of the voters voted to stay within the French Republic. So in 2018, 56%, in 2020, 53%. And in 2021, the Kanak independent movement decided to boycott the referendum because they thought that the COVID-19 pandemic had disproportionately affected the Kanak communities. To summarize, these electoral results, the three referendums, highlighted a very crude reality, which is that ethnicity basically decides the vote in New Caledonia. The Kanak population will overwhelmingly vote for independence, and the other communities, French, Asians, Polynesian, would mostly vote to remain within the French Republic. So what had initially been designed as a consensual and democratic pathway towards a final statute has resulted into renewed confrontation. And that's what's happening right now. A key issue, I told you, is the restricted electoral role for elections. It excludes almost 20% of the Caledonian population from local elections. So this is clearly contrary to some fundamental rights guaranteed by the French constitution. Now that the Nouméa Accord in 1998 have expired after the third referendum, the French government has deemed these restrictions no longer justified. The government decided to lift the restriction on the electoral roll. Obviously, the independence movement were totally against this reform. So what happened is when the legislation was voted at the National Assembly, that was 1 year ago in May 2024, violent riots erupted in Nouméa and surrounding area that led to 14 people dead, including two police officers, 100 of injured, and notably economic collapse. Like, it's been said that in 1 year, there's been an economic contraction of about 15%, which is massive.
Yeah.
So right now we're in a political deadlock, I would say. The French Ministry of Overseas, Manuel Valls, who is an important political figure because he was prime minister 10 years ago, just came back from New Caledonia with very limited results. Emmanuel Macron announced today that he was going to invite all the political leaders in Paris next month. So yeah, we're kind of waiting. We don't know what to expect, but there is a major event on the agenda, is the coming provincial elections in 2025, which could which raises fears of further unrest. I'm sorry that was quite long.
No, thank you. I mean, that was, you know, it's a complex set of issues, and I'm sure, you know, myself included, most of our listeners, I don't think have a very good understanding of the background and the context. So thank you for that. I think that's a very helpful walkthrough. You know, we're coming to the end of our time for today's discussion on the show, but I wanted to ask you to just reflect a little bit on what you just said. Can you say a little bit about the extent to which external players might have been opportunistic in trying to influence events in New Caledonia? You know, China, Russia, I know there's been a little bit of concern about, you know, Turkey, Azerbaijan. Can you say a little bit about how much of that is true and borne out, and whether that's going to more broadly affect the way in which France is thinking about its overseas possessions in the Indo-Pacific?
Sure. So, yeah. Well, New Caledonia might seem very far away and a very secondary subject, but it's also the fifth worldwide reserve in nickel. Yeah. So what makes it a very strategic territory. And so people have been speculating on foreign interference from several actors, mostly China, Russia, and Azerbaijan, in the local elections to undermine French global presence in the region. That might be true. I don't have personally elements to support this. I mean, is China looking at the region? Yes. Is it looking specifically at New Caledonia? We're not sure, but we also have to point out that Chinese influence in the surrounding islands in the last decade has been huge, notably in Vanuatu or in Tonga. So yeah, China is a subject, but I'm not sure we already have a clear evidence on Chinese interference. Azerbaijan is a more funny story because it's related to another rivalry or conflict in Europe, right, between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan accuses France of supporting Armenia, and so it has interfered in the electoral process in New Caledonia via the Baku Initiative Group, where they would invite independent leaders from every French overseas territories. So you had Kanak independence leader, you had French Polynesian independence leaders, you even had leaders from La Réunion at the Baku Initiative Group, which is kind of, it's more funny than anything else because independence movement in La Réunion are very marginal. So yeah, I think from Azerbaijan is more a contextual interference to undermine French influence, right, in
global. Well, Paco, I want to thank you, first of all, for taking the time today to share a little bit of your impressions and expertise on France's broader approach to the Indo-Pacific, and for particularly walking our listeners through the situation over the last year in New Caledonia. I think it's a very useful and important piece of context. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you very much, Shankit, and
thank you very much. So for listeners, as always, Katie and I will be back soon with more on this podcast. But if you've enjoyed the show, including today's discussion, make sure you subscribe so you can keep up with future episodes. And if you've been a subscriber for a while, please do leave us a review. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts. We really do appreciate that. It helps the show grow quite a bit. In the meantime, of course, I hope you'll keep well, and we look forward to being back on the show soon. Thanks a lot for listening. Katie and I will be back soon with more.